November 2nd, 2017. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Folk Runyon. And tonight, we present a discussion on the biblical mystery man, Melchizedek, who appears in the first book of the Bible, Genesis, and later in the New Testament. Melchizedek literally means king and priest, or priest-king. He was said to have given the first communion to Abraham in the days before Joseph became a leader in Egypt. Now, although he's legendary, he was said to have established an order of priesthood to rival that of Moses' brother Aaron. Melchizedek represented the original Canaanite god El, the Most High God, whereas Aaron's priesthood was that of Moses' Jehovah, Yahweh. After the Babylonian captivity, Ezra attempted to overwrite all references to El in the Bible and make Jehovah the supreme being. The New Testament declares twice that Jesus the Nazarene is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, we will look at this in relation to the Egyptian and Phoenician situation at the time, and later Gnostic Christian writings about Melchizedek. So, if you want to do some biblical detective work, tune in, stay with us, and we'll solve the mystery. I'll be joined tonight by Frater Solomon, Michael Johnson, our biblical scholar, and my co-author on several projects such as this one. But before we bring Mike on board, let me set the stage for this discussion on Melchizedek. Now, just as important as the question who, what, and when was Melchizedek is the perhaps more important question who, what, and when was Abraham. And according to the Bible, Abraham, originally Abram, was the founding patriarch of the Hebrew people. He was a Chaldean from Ur, Uar, a city at the mouth of the Euphrates River on the Persian Gulf. Now, supposedly, this was around 1500 B.C., about the same time the Ugarit tablets were written over in Canaan. He had a vision of one God that led him and his tribe out of Mesopotamia in search of a new land. He and his people went north to Haran, the city of the moon god Sin, and they stayed there long enough to make souls and also to get a lunar calendar for the Hebrew people. And then they went southwest down into Canaan, where Abram fought and won a battle with three rival tribes from Babylon. And then he visited Melchizedek in what is now Jerusalem. In those days, it was just Salem, and the Jeru part comes from the Jebusites. Now, the Canaanite priest king was a priest of the Most High God, according to Genesis, which was, of course, the Canaanite El, which we are to assume was Abram's muse. And so the Chaldean warlord, the patriarch Abraham, accepted the Canaanite El, which we, you know, Melchizedek sealed this covenant with a communion of bread and wine, which later was the model for the Christian communion. And he renamed Abram Abraham, the perfected one. Now, there was a famine in Palestine very shortly thereafter. They didn't call it Palestine in those days. And Abraham and his people moved south into Egypt. This was the first of several Hebrew refugee invasions of the Black Land. and probably one military invasion. And the question, who, what, and when was Abraham, is important because he, the original patriarch and first prophet of his nation, accepted El, the Most High God of the Canaanites, as the same voice that had been leading him and his tribe since they left Babylon. Unfortunately, several hundred years later, another great Hebrew prophet, Moses, heard a voice that claimed to be the God of Abraham, but was in fact something else. The Old Testament, as we have it today, had been edited and rewritten by Ezra before and after the Babylonian captivity in a clumsy attempt to replace El with Yahweh, and thus obscure the historical existence of two rival Hebrew priesthoods, that of Moses and his brother Aaron and Levites, and that of Melchizedek's Abraham, David, Solomon, and Jesus. Now that should set us up. Brother Solomon, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh yeah, I can hear you loud and clear. That's basically the setup. You know, reason why I said that it's just as important that we talk about who Abraham was and as Melchizedek and the time frame and everything is because without Abraham and this communion, we really don't have a mystery. Do you think actually that Abraham dates back as far as 1500 BC? I'm wondering if it might not be a lot later. What do you think?
I think I'm pretty close here, Abraham, Melchizedek, 18 after Noah or before. Before Moses, even Moses is a mystery, but I'd have to think that he'd have to be.
What's the matter? I lost you. Yeah, call back in, Michael. Anyway, so I will continue. You really think Abraham was as far back as 1500 BC?
Well, let's see, on chronology, he'd have to be he's probably a couple centuries before Solomon, which would be 1000 AD, but he couldn't be that far back because the stories are too interwoven. They're too connected. I'd put him maybe more around, 1200, 1300. I'm just guessing on that.
I think that works out a lot better. Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, when Ezra and his crew were making these genealogies up, they wanted to have these profoundly long lifetimes, which they kind of would have maybe gotten from the Chaldeans or the Egyptians. They both like to make their kings live several centuries or even thousands of years long. The further they went back, it was just the whole how ancient can we make our kings sound, because it added to the prestige. You have these long-living kings who lived centuries ago, and then all of a sudden it's just these guys are larger than life. And when they were larger than life, then their descendants felt like they were larger than life as well.
Yeah, in the case of Melchizedek, legend has it that his name was really Shem, and that he was the only survivor of the flood. In other words, he was either hanging onto a rope hanging from the ark, or he was somehow found himself a tree that was tall enough, and I don't know how he survived the flood, but the Jewish legend has it that he was the last survivor of the flood, and that he was immortal, basically, that he, and they, that all through the Melchizedek legend, you find this, the these references not just to his immortality, but to his, frankly, it seems like to his reincarnation. I know we get that both out of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They seem to indicate that he's going to reincarnate in the future, and the Nag Hammadi tract seems to indicate that he is going to continually reincarnate if he doesn't, in fact, actually continue to live. What were we going to say?
Well, there is something interesting. Reading the tractate, it's a revelation from Gamaliel, who is a sort of an archangel who is above the seventh heaven. So he's above Ezra's Jehovah's heaven. And this archangel Gamaliel is giving a revelation to Jesus Christ, telling him he is the reincarnation of Melchizedek. So there is the connection there. A lot of early Christians actually believed that Melchizedek was a pre-incarnation of Jesus Christ. And the whole Gnostic tractate, it's really beautiful. It's much more detailed than the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls do, pretty interestingly, they make Melchizedek identical with Michael the Archangel and the Prince of Light and his adversary that he fights against. So Melchizedek's a very big figure in the Dead Sea community. But his arch nemesis was Melchi Resha.
Belial.
Yes, Belial. So Melchizedek is the great angelic being who can defeat Belial. And you and I, we both had a very interesting channeling with Melchizedek some time ago. He's really a fascinating character that I'm glad that we brought into our just our whole story, our milieu, and what we're presenting. It's not just Solomon. It's not just David. It's not just Jesus Christ, which I think is a very important development within the OTA. But this fabulous character Melchizedek, who's very powerful, and who also connects us to a tradition where we are going above what Ezra created. Ezra got his followers to the seventh heaven, but with the Gnostic tradition, we are going up to the 365th heaven, from which Gamaliel is associated with, and comes down to reveal to Jesus Christ who he was in a previous incarnation. This character, yeah. Melchizedek, he's very fascinating. One thing, and it's just kind of a side note, but it's very telling. Joshua, when he was going up against the Canaanites, the adversary who was in charge of Jebus or Salem, his name was Adonizedek. And according to the book of Jasher, Adonizedek was another name of Melchizedek. So here we have kind of you know, the fellows associated with the Levites going against the fellows associated with Melchizedek. So it's not just a lower priesthood versus a higher priesthood, which those who are trying to carry on Ezra's tradition would try to say, oh, it's just a lower priesthood versus higher priesthood. But these two priesthoods were actually against each other, which we see with Joshua and Phinehas, Aaron's son, going up against Adonizedek, who is the king of Jebus or the king of Salem.
This is probably one of the biggest mistakes that most of the Christian churches, especially the Roman Church, made when they kicked out poor old Saint Valentine, you know, they and told him to go away and wouldn't let him become Pope. It's one of the biggest mistakes they made was this realization that Melchizedek L, that Jesus really was Emmanuel, and that L was really the Father God, and the priesthood of David, of Solomon, and Jesus, of the house of David, that this really was the priesthood that they should have attached themselves to out of the Old Testament. But instead of that, they all accepted Ezra's rewrite. Ezra went through the Bible, and every time he saw L, he stuck in YHVH, and unfortunately, the Christians, well, Valentine didn't, and the Gnostic Christians realized that. In fact, they even called Jehovah the Demiurge. They knew it. They realized it, and this is one of the terrible mistake. The King James Bible and the Vulgate and it probably the worst mistake scriptural mistake that the Christians made. And Martin Luther didn't pick it up. And so the Protestants there are Protestant churches, as you know, Worldwide Church of God is one of them, and I think even the Mormon Church has to some degree a recognition of the fact that L. That is the real Father God, but unfortunately our Bibles don't reflect this, and most of the problems that we have with fundamental Christians arise out of analogies from the Old Testament. You know, all these horrible things that happened in the Old Testament that are attributed either to Jehovah or to his prophets, like for instance all those awful atrocities in the book of Judges and things like that, and polygamy and all of these various these really reprehensible attitudes and things that have come through to Christianity, and unfortunately fundamental Christianity and Catholicism seem to you can trace them back to the fact that we did not have a right priesthood. We're still under the spell of Ezra's rewrite.
You bring up something that I might want to shed some light on, and this is actually something that you and I have talked about before, but one thing that's revealing of these priesthoods being totally distinct to each other in their attitudes is towards women. Ezra was promoting divorce, but not divorce like we have it today, where it's two people deciding together that they don't get along, but where the husband simply says, I don't want to be married to you anymore. You're not going to be my wife anymore. That's it. We're divorced. You get nothing. Whereas Jesus, you could actually see Jesus as poking at Ezra, because Jesus says, well, Moses said that you could be divorced, but God really doesn't like that. God doesn't want you to get divorced. It was because they were weak people that was allowed. But really, when you get married, you're not supposed to be finding ways to put your wife away so she gets nothing and you just leave her aside, because divorce back then was really a way of taking absolutely everything away from the woman. And Jesus's attitude was, no, we have to protect our women. We have to treat them as equals. And we have to be in it for the long haul to take care of them. That's the attitude that we need to have.
Well, not only that, Jesus actually believed, and of course this goes even against Plato, and Jesus believed that your soul was not complete until you got married, that this romantic idea of your soulmate, soulmate idea was a distortion of the idea that when you get married, she's your soulmate, whether that was esoterically ordained or not. And Jesus said very, very clearly, he said, "What God hath bound together, let no man put asunder," and he meant it.
In reality. Napoleon Hill, in his book Think and Grow Rich, in his research on successful men and all the key ingredients, one of the key factors he said is, behind every good man is a good woman. If a successful man is to be successful, you will virtually always see a supportive woman by his side who is his bulwark of support. Without that key ingredient of a supportive woman, then you don't have what you need to really be everything that you can be.
That's right. And in fact, right now, it's interesting to note that right now we're having this as part of the cultural Marxist attempt to destroy our society. Their latest thing is to promote it, women to come forward and accuse men of whatever they can accuse them of from as far back as their almost childhood, to insist that women have equality in the creative fields. I just noticed that a prominent editor, New York editor, came out and to answer the question, why are there so few women artists and writers? And basically, it is that men do tend to be more outgoing in the creative fields. You can say this is, you know, kind of the sexual analogy or whatever, however you want to say it, but this is natural that when it comes to works of art and literature and everything else, men have predominated, and they will probably continue to predominate as far as that is concerned. But at the same time, there's behind every great artist and behind every great writer, there's always a very, very inspiring woman. And if you don't think so, just look at the dedications to the books and the works. And this is something that I'm not saying that we haven't had great lady authors, writers, artists, and all. We have, and certainly we'll have more. But the nature of things is that men like that saying, you know, that men do and women are, you know, and there's always lots of exceptions to that. And of course, in the Hermetic tradition, we have Hypatia, and of course, you can also mentioned, well, not gosh, Margaret Thatcher and even give Olenka Blavatsky some credit for creativity, because she certainly did create a lot. So I'm all for, and we should be for women's equality and the expression and everything, but we also should consider nature. And Jesus was Jesus looking at the Genesis Garden of Eden formula, Eve and Adam together. You know, she was Adam's helpmate, and this is really kind of the nature of nurture and creativity. But to get back to Melchizedek, the true nature, Melchizedek's true nature and the significance is, as I say, one of the big things philosophically behind Christianity that has been somehow or other I won't say swept under the rug, but it's been distorted, and the distortion, of course, goes back to Ezra, and so he accomplished it. But the priesthood of David, Solomon, and Jesus was certainly based on Melchizedek's original communion, and the Father God was Father El, who even back in ancient, most ancient times, the Canaanite over god El was referred to as El the Compassionate. Now, let's think about that Gnostic story of Melchizedek that was written down by Athanasius, the patriarch of Alexandria, in the second century. I know you're familiar with it. That's we have it in the Old Testament Pseudographia, the first volume. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really it's really neat, because it presents Ezra as a Canaanite king, which he was, and I think his grandmother's name was Salem, for whom the town was named.
You mean Melchizedek.
Oh my gosh, can't believe I said that.
yeah.
Two diametrically opposed characters. It's really pretty interesting, because we have Melchizedek as the son of a pagan state, and it's him and his brother, and some of this is just rehashing of legends about Abraham, and Melchizedek says to his father, well, how can your many gods be the real gods when the sun goes down, it's gone, but then the moon comes up, so which one's really God? And there's the whole story of Terah that's kind of rehashed, where Abraham chops up all of Terah's idols, because he was an idol maker, and he puts the axe at the foot of the biggest one, and Terah comes in and says, "What did you do to all of my idols?" And Abraham says, "I didn't do it, Dad. It was the largest, powerful than the rest, so he chopped the rest up." So there's a similar story about Melchizedek, and Melchizedek's father, King Melchi, doesn't really like his younger son very much. He had two sons, I believe they were twins, Melchi and Melchizedek. And he was going to sacrifice Melchizedek, and there are, I believe it's, there are going to be seven cows sacrificed to the 12 gods. And these 12 gods, of course.
He sent Melchizedek out to round up the cattle and bring them in, and Melchizedek didn't do it. I don't think I'm wondering about that. Why he ended up sacrificing. First, he wanted to sacrifice the cows or the heifers, and Melchizedek wouldn't do that, and then he ends up wanting to sacrifice Melchizedek himself, and his wife. You know, his wife talks him out of it, or Melchizedek's mother, and says, "Why don't we draw lots on that?" and she manages to get Melchizedek off the hook on that. But then Melchi turns around and he sacrifices about 300 of the firstborn of his people. He got this huge orgy of human sacrifice. And Melchizedek is so upset by it that he calls down a curse, and then the whole city, and this is in Jerusalem, but the city that his father controls, the whole city falls into a sinkhole. This sounds like Ubar. Remember how Ubar,
yeah.
Ubar went down? Yeah, it sounds very much like Ubar, and the whole city falls into a gigantic sinkhole, and is destroyed. And Melchizedek, of course, is so upset by that because he brought this curse down and all that. So he goes off into the wilderness, like John the Baptist. He goes off into the wilderness and he's naked, and his fingernails get long, and his hair gets long, and he looks like Howard Hughes, and you know.
Yes, yes, very much John the Baptist.
Yeah, John the Baptist, and the way he's described is like Howard Hughes in the last days.
Right.
His long fingernails and his long hair and everything, and then God comes along and tells Abraham. Hey, Abraham, I want you to go up to Mount Tabor, go up there and find this wild man and take a razor and I don't know what they used for shaving cream in those days, but, you know, take a razor and some shears up there, clip his fingernails and shave his beard off and cut his hair and bring him down and he'll give you his blessing. And so Abraham does this. And so Melchizedek returns to the world of the living and becomes the priest of the temple. But the interesting thing about this is that Melchizedek and Abraham have the same vision, you know, this vision of the one God. And I think that this, how much of this is Athanasius's creativity and how much of this, you know, might have come down from old legends, I don't know.
I think you can clearly see as a rehash. Like, one of the problems with Melchizedek being alone in the wilderness and found by Abraham, I like this story, but it's missing an element, which is Melchizedek was already established king. And if you're a king, you can't be a king of no one and really be a king. So Melchizedek had to have a stable community in Salem or thereabouts. And I do think it was in that area. And the reason why is because Adonizedek is the king of Jebus, which is the same area as Jerusalem and the same area as Salem, because Salem was just the older name for Jerusalem. So I do think that Melchizedek had already been around with a tiny little kingdom in this city state of his. And for some reason, this story kind of misses that. And I think it mixes in a couple of legends. It's mixing in the legend of Ubar. I don't think that the whole city sunk. That doesn't quite pass the smell test, because where was Melchizedek's kingdom? Because in this story, we have Abraham's really the one in charge, because he's coming to a madman, basically, and shaving him and cleaning him up, and this guy doesn't even have a kingdom. Whereas in the New Testament and Old Testament, we have Melchizedek. He's the one who's taking offerings from Abraham. Abraham is coming to Melchizedek for a blessing, not vice versa. So this story, it's whatever the original story was, it's been shaken up a little bit, where Melchizedek is, you know, when he's a kid, he's sort of a young Abraham. That story from Jubilees, I believe it's Jubilees, is kind of mixed in. The legend of Ubar is mixed in. The legend of John the Baptist is mixed in. And I do think that Melchizedek was a spiritual mystic, much in the vein that John the Baptist followed. But I don't think that he lost his entire city. So some of it's definitely mixed up. But one thing that's neat about Melchizedek that I do think is true is him offering a sacrament of bread and wine, which didn't involve the animal slaughter that was performed by the Levitical priesthood. And the reason for that is I think Melchizedek's message was, we don't need to kill animals in order to sacrifice our God.
Yeah, I think you're right. And of course, as we mentioned before, the original Elohists were vegetarian or almost vegan, and of course Daniel, you know, Daniel
was,
over
yep.
in the Babylonian captivity, Daniel was obviously one of the Davidians, and he was an Elohist,
right?
And interestingly enough, so many things of the Ezra conspiracy. You know, this people love conspiracies. Well, the Ezra, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest conspiracy in the Bible was Ezra's rewrite
certainly was.
Here's the thing that Ezra managed to accomplish. Along with this conspiracy. Okay, Cyrus, he's in cahoots with Cyrus. Cyrus is going to send him back to Canaan, back to Jerusalem, and not only is he going to send him back, he's going to send him back with funding to rebuild the temple, and the Persian army to back him up. And so what Ezra is going to do is he's going to establish a satellite, you know, like the communists used to have these countries, and they still do, you know, that are satellites that Judea and Israel were going to be a satellite of the Persian Empire. And of course, Ezra helped Cyrus helped Ezra rewrite the Bible, because that was going to be used to conquer all of Israel, the Canaanites, because the ten so-called lost tribes, you know, were not really lost. They never left. They were the Canaanites and the Phoenicians, and so you know, the important thing about this is that Ezra, leaves these people back, but he leaves he leaves all of the Davidians in Babylon. He goes back.
They were a big threat to his power.
They were a big threat to his power, obviously. So the Davidians stay in Babylon, and Ezra takes the Levites with him, Levites and Benjamin, and Judah and Benjamin and the Levites.
Jesus actually mentions an interesting story about David, which is David is going and he's eating the sacred grain with his men, and it was something only a priest was entitled to do. And David's argument was, I'm a priest after the order of Melchizedek, so I have a right to do this. And that was the big conflict, is there was this persistent conflict between the kings of Judah and the priesthood of Aaron, always not getting along. And it was only when they got along that Ezra praised them when he's going back in history. But when they did get along, Ezra says, oh, this was an evil king. It's never the priest who was evil. It was always the king from the Davidic line who was evil. And just to cap this, because I don't want this to be forgotten, it's very fascinating. There's a legend that says Tamar, who is the ancestor of King David and King Solomon, she married Judah. She was a Canaanite. So this puts them at variance with the Levitical priesthood, which is not claiming the same Canaanite heritage. So we have a direct line from Melchizedek, the Canaanite, down to David, Solomon, and Jesus. This means Jesus is the ancestral mother of Jesus's tribe was a Canaanite. And according to Ezra, this was, there's a story about Ezra. This shows how horrible Ezra was, and it also shows how much disregard Ezra had for the Davidic line. It was kind of a snub. All these men who came back with Ezra, Ezra wants them to send their Canaanite wives and their children, and this is awful, back to the in-laws, the Canaanite in-laws. And basically, how horrible does Ezra have to be to promote divorce to the degree that you send your wives back to the in-laws and your own children because they don't share your Levitical heritage? It's just absolutely horrid what Ezra was able to accomplish. And it also shows how much Jesus really had disdain for Ezra, even though he never bluntly said it. He did say, yeah, this divorce thing, it's not of God. It's not of hell. This is an invention, and Jesus was essentially saying, no, Ezra, you didn't have it right. You were not following El. This is what El really wants, and that's what Jesus was really doing, and that's what we get gleams of in the Gnostic tradition, is of this higher tradition, of this higher infinite God, who really sees marriage as a sacred union and sees women as a special attachment to men who are to be prized and not discarded, really like cattle.
Yes, you hit it right on the nose, and I think that as we're looking at this, we have to say as a qualifier, that the Bible, as we have it, the Bible is mythology.
It is.
It's mythology, and it is no less valid than many examples of Greek mythology. They have just as much genuine historical significance as the Bible, because just as for an example, the Hebrews. Sure, they were suppressed and miserable in Egypt, but that was only because they had conquered Egypt and made the Egyptians miserable for about 300 years, And then finally, the Egyptians forced them all up there, you know, to the Tanis area, up there in the land of Goshen. You know, my grandma used to say, "Land of Goshen." Yeah, that's where the Hebrews were. They didn't. This idea that the Hebrews were forced to build the pyramids was a lot of that was a load of that's a load of hooey. The pyramids were about 3,000 years before
right.
The Egyptian captivity. They had nothing to do with that, but they had conquered as the Hyksos, and I have, by the way, I was just showing this to Andrea. I have the Atlas of the Bible Lands that was produced by Hammond way back about 40 years ago, and I still have my copy. And they have this wonderful time chart of Bible history on the front cover and inside the back, inside the covers, and this chart is about 3 feet long, and it's got the Hebrews, the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, the Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Hittites, and the Persians, all running in these big long lines parallel to each other. And this is one of these things that you really can figure out what is going on in our mythology. And as I say, the Bible's mythology, but it is so important. It's so important mythology that, doggone it, I believe if we had a time machine right now and we could go back in time, back to these biblical periods, I'll bet that what we would see is the mythology, not what actually happened, and how they would manage to do the Hyksos and Moses. And the Hebrews, I don't know, that'd probably make the time machine blow a fuse because the reason is, if you look at this timeline chart and you come down here, Hyksos invaders rule Egypt, and this is right on the Hebrew chart, this is right during the sojourn in Egypt. And it's and it also in the Egyptian line, it's Hyksos invaders rule Egypt. And there's you know, the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, they had a war god named Sutekh, and they equated him with Set when they took over Egypt. They equated their war god Sutekh with Set, the Egyptian Satan, and made the Egyptians forced the Egyptians to venerate Set, and killed Egyptian sacred animals, and just literally made the Egyptians miserable for about 300 years, until the Egyptians finally got the Ethiopians to help them and drove these Hyksos or Hebrews up into the Delta area, and up to Tanis, you know, in Indiana Jones, where Indiana Jones and the Nazis were digging for the Ark. That's where they drove them, and so their version. And then Moses, of course, was, according to Manetho, the last historian of the Egyptians, Moses was a renegade priest of Osiris, who was the last of the Hyksos. And he led when the Egyptians finally pushed him out, Moses led the last of the Hyksos back to Canaan. And so, you know, we don't know, but we, for the sake of argument, we accept the Exodus story and we deal with that. And with the same thing, you know, as I say, in some areas of Greek mythology, we accept these. We accept this because it's part of our belief system. And so looking at what Ezra did, he didn't just mess with history. He messed with our sacred mythology, and we might as well consider that messing with, you know, rewriting history because we follow it, and it is, it really is, as I say, the substituting of Yahweh for El was really a. Really, an Orwellian. It was an Orwellian thing to do, and probably one of the worst conspiracies that's been inflicted on civilization. You want to comment somewhat on Melchizedek's influence? Well, he has influenced a number of churches. What are the Mormon views on Melchizedek?
Well, Melchizedek was not necessarily the founder, because he was continuing something that actually existed before the flood. But he was the holder of the full priesthood. The Levitical priesthood was a lesser priesthood, which you graduate from in the Mormon religion when you turn 18. When you become an adult, you receive the full priesthood, which is the Melchizedek priesthood, which allows you to do everything, all the blessings, you know, blessing the communion, the sacrament of. Well, they do bread and water now. It used to be bread and wine, but they changed it because they thought there was a conspiracy where their wine was getting poisoned, so they switched to bread and water. Essentially, if you wanted the priesthood where you could be married forever to your soulmate, that would be conducted through the Melchizedek priesthood. And the Levitical priesthood was... just a lesser priesthood that allowed you to bless the communion, but nothing more. All the high powers of blessing people when they're born, when they get married, when they pass on, that was all held within the Melchizedek priesthood. The priesthood which Jesus had in its fullness, that was the Melchizedek priesthood.
But then what in the Mormon Bible, what happens with Yahweh?
Well, their tradition is interesting. They do equate Yahweh with Jesus, and I'm not saying that we should even consider doing that, but they do make Elohim the superior God of the two. And I think that's interesting because they're seeing Elohim and Jehovah as separate entities and Elohim as the superior entity. And one thing that I think is fascinating and significant, getting a little bit away from the Mormons, because I think I've captured everything that they're about as far as Melchizedek's concerned. But it was really Wellhausen in Germany. He's an awesome German scholar who realized, hey, wait a minute. I'm reading these five books of Moses, and I'm noticing some of the stories are about Elohim, which is an extended name of El, and other stories are about Jehovah. And the interesting thing about that is if you read Genesis chapter 1, where it's saying God, that's really Elohim in Hebrew. And where it's saying Lord God or Lord, that's Jehovah. Now, the story of Elohim, when he creates from the heavens by his word alone. So El has a significant amount of power. Elohim, you know, it says, I created man in my image. Elohim is sort of a plural term where God is, you know, in our image. That is El and Asherat, because it's two beings. It has the Ohim, which is a plural ending, so it's referring to at least two entities. And it's referring to is the Canaanite pantheon headed by El and Asherah. That's how man is created, in our image, not in my image. And then the second chapter, you have Jehovah. You have Jehovah.
Evolves,
he has to create on the ground.
Right. Which evolves, according to the Nestorian document, and can be confirmed all the way through the Bible if you know how to read it. El and Asherot have their counterparts on Earth of Baal and Astarte, Isis and Osiris, Venus and Adonis, and all of the. We might mention that Elohim is the pantheon. It's not just God, it's the pantheon. And they're all aspects, and some of them are earthly aspects. And so eventually, Jesus, and this is another sort of a conspiracy that was inflicted upon the Christian New Testament, or whatever, is the glorification of Mother Mary, supposedly, and the downgrading of Jesus' wife, Mary Magdalene. And so really, we have, you know, if you want to take this thing from a Canaanite point of view, El and Mother Asherot had their counterpart on Earth, Baal and Astarte, who eventually evolve through all of this into Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and that of course is the final, you know, the final secret behind all of this. And we're just about running this about to the end of the hour, and I want to really thank you, Mike, for coming on board on this and giving us all your knowledge. And I think that people who have not heard of any of this before, and I think they may we really have given them a lot to think about, and we certainly I won't say we've solved the mystery of Melchizedek, but we certainly have honored Melchizedek and given people, as I say, quite a bit to think about. So we'll be back next week with another stimulating discussion. And so until then. Good magic, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Good magic.